with Anita when she took driving lessons. Once they had got happily drunk on a bottle of wine they stole from the house. For several weeks the two of them had also stayed at Gottfried's cabin on the very tip of the island. The questions about Harriet's private thoughts and feelings remained unanswered, but Blomqvist did make a note of a discrepancy in the report. The information about her uncommunicative frame of mind came chiefly from her classmates, and to a certain extent from the family. Anita Wanger had not thought of her as being introverted at all. He made a note to discuss this matter with Wanger at some point. A more concrete question to which Morell had devoted much more attention was a surprising page in Harriet's date book, a beautiful bound book she had been given as a Christmas present the year before she disappeared. The first half of the date book was a day-by-day calendar, in which Harriet had listed meetings, the dates of exams at school, her homework, and so on. The date book also had a large section for a diary, but Harriet used the diary only sporadically. She began ambitiously enough in January, with many brief entries about people she had met over the Christmas holidays, and several about films she had seen. After that she wrote nothing personal until the end of the school year, when she apparently, depending on how the entries were interpreted, became interested from a distance in some never-named boy. The pages that listed telephone numbers were the ones that held the real mystery. Neatly, in alphabetical order, were the names and numbers of family members, classmates, certain teachers, several members of the Pentecostal congregation, and other easily identifiable individuals in her circle of acquaintances. On the very last page of the address book, which was blank and not really part of the alphabetical section, there were five names and telephone numbers, three female names and two sets of initials. Magda, 32016, Sarah, 32109, R.J., 30112, R.L., 32027, Mari, 32018. The telephone numbers that began with 32 were Hedestad numbers in the 60s. The one beginning with 30 was a Norbin number, not far from Hedestad. The problem was that when Morell contacted every one of Harriet's friends and acquaintances, no one had any idea whose numbers they were. The first number, belonging to Magda, initially seemed promising. It led to a haberdashery at Park Garden 12. The telephone was in the name of one Margot Lundmark, whose mother's name was actually Magda. She sometimes helped out in the store. But Magda was 69 years old and had no idea who Harriet Wanger was, nor was there any evidence that Harriet had ever visited the shop or bought anything there. She wasn't interested in sewing. The second number for Sarah belonged to a family by the name of Torsson, who lived in Veststan, on the other side of the tracks. The family included Anders and Monica, and their children Jonas and Peter, who at the time were preschool age. There was no Sarah in the family, nor did they know of Harriet Wanger, other than that she had been reported in the media as missing. The only vague connection between Harriet and the Torreson family was that Anders, who was a roofer, had several weeks earlier put a tiled roof on the school which Harriet attended, so theoretically there was a chance that they had met, although it might be considered extremely unlikely. The remaining three numbers led to similar dead ends. The number 32027, for R.L., had actually belonged to one Rosemary Larsen. Unfortunately, she had died several years earlier. Inspector Morell concentrated a great deal of his attention during the winter of 1966-67 on trying to explain why Harriet had written down these names and numbers. One possibility was that the telephone numbers were written in some personal code, so Morell tried to guess how a teenage girl would think. Since the 32 series obviously pointed to Hedestad, he set about rearranging the remaining three digits. Neither 32601 or 32160 led to a Magda. As Morell continued his numerology, he realized that if he played around with enough of the numbers, sooner or later he would find some link to Harriet. For example, he added 1 to each of the three remaining digits in 32016. He got 32127, which was the number to Froda's office in Hedestad. But one link like that meant nothing. Besides, he never discovered a code that made sense of all 5 of the numbers. Morell broadened his inquiry. Could the digits mean, for example, car number plates, which in the 60s contained the 2-letter county registration code and 5 digits? Another dead end. The inspector then concentrated on the names. He obtained a list of everyone in Hedestad named Mari, Magda, or Sarah, and who had initials R.L. or R.J. He had a list of 307 people. Among these, 29 actually had some connection to Harriet. For instance, a boy from her class was named Roland Jacobson, R.J. They scarcely knew each other and had had no contact since Harriet started preparatory school, and there was no link to the telephone number. The mystery of the numbers in the date book remained unsolved. Her fourth encounter with Advocate Bjurman was not one of their scheduled meetings. She was forced to make contact with him. In the second week of February, Salander's laptop fell victim to an accident that was so uncalled for that she felt an urgent desire to kill someone. She had ridden her bike to a meeting at Milton Security and parked it behind a pillar in the garage. As she set her rucksack on the ground to put on the bike lock, a dark red Saab began reversing out. She had her back turned, but heard the cracking sound from her rucksack. The driver didn't notice a thing and, unwitting, drove off up the exit ramp. The rucksack contained her white Apple iBook 600 with a 25-gig hard drive and 420 megs of RAM, manufactured in January 2002 and equipped with a 14-inch screen. At the time she bought it, it was Apple's state-of-the-art laptop. Salander's computers were upgraded with the very latest and sometimes most expensive configurations. Computer equipment was the only extravagant entry on her list of expenses. When she opened the rucksack, she could see that the lid of her computer was cracked. She plugged in the power adapter and tried to boot up the computer. Not even a death rattle. She took it over to Timmy's McJesus shop on Brunkirkegarten, hoping that at least something on the hard drive could be saved. After fiddling with it for a short time, Timmy shook his head. "Sorry, no hope," he said. "You'll have to arrange a nice funeral." The loss of her computer was depressing but not disastrous. Salander had had an excellent relationship with it during the year she had owned it. She had backed up all her documents, and she had an older desktop Mac G3 at home, as well as a 5-year-old Toshiba PC laptop that she could use, but she needed a fast, modern machine. Unsurprisingly, she set her sights on the best available alternative, the new Apple PowerBook G4/1.0 GHz in an aluminium case with a PowerPC 7451 processor with an Altivec Velocity engine, 960 megabytes of RAM, and a 60-gigabyte hard drive. It had Bluetooth and built-in CD and DVD burners. Best of all, it had the first 17-inch screen in the laptop world, with NVIDIA graphics and a resolution of 1440 by 900 pixels, which shook the PC advocates and outranked everything else on the market. In terms of hardware, it was the Rolls-Royce of portable computers, but what really triggered Salander's need to have it was the simple feature that the keyboard was equipped with backlighting, so that she could see the letters even if it was pitch dark. So simple. Why had no one thought of that before? It was love at first sight. It cost 38,000 kronor, plus tax. That was the problem. Come what may, she put in her order at McJesus. She bought all her computer accessories there, so they gave her a reasonable discount. She tallied up her expenses. The insurance on her ruined computer would cover a good part of the price, but with the warranty and the higher price of her new acquisition, she was still 18,000 kroner short. She had 10,000 kroner hidden in a coffee tin at home, but that was all. She sent evil thoughts to Herr Bjurman, but then she bit the bullet and called her guardian to explain that she needed money for an unexpected expense. Bjurman's secretary said that he had no time to see her that day. Salander replied that it would take the man 20 seconds to write out a cheque for 10,000 kroner. She was told to be at his office at 7:30 that evening. Blomqvist might have no experience of evaluating criminal investigations, but he reckoned that Inspector Morell had been exceptionally conscientious. When Blomqvist had finished with a police investigation, Morell still kept turning up as a player in Wanger's own notes. They had become friends, and Blomqvist wondered whether Morell had been as obsessed as the captain of industry became. It was unlikely, in his view, that Morell had missed anything. The solution to the mystery was not going to be found in the police records. Every imaginable question had been asked, and all leads followed up, even some that seemed absurdly far-fetched. He had not read every word of the report, but the further into the investigation he got, the more obscure the subsequent leads and tips became. He He was not going to find anything that his professional predecessor and his experienced team had missed, and he was undecided what approach he should adopt to the problem. Eventually it came to him that the only reasonably practical route for him to take was to try to find out the psychological motives of the individuals involved. The first question had to do with Harriet herself. Who was she? From his kitchen window, Blomqvist had noticed a light go on upstairs in Cecilia Wanger's house at a little after 5 in the afternoon. He knocked on her door at 7:30, just as the news broadcast was starting on TV. She opened the door dressed in her bathrobe, her hair wet under a yellow towel. Blomqvist apologized at once for disturbing her and made to retreat, but she waved him into the living room. She turned on the coffee maker and vanished upstairs for a few minutes. When she came back down, she had put on jeans and a check flannel shirt. "I was starting to think you were never going to call." "I should have rung first, but I saw your light was on and came over on impulse. I've seen the lights on all night at your place, and you're often out walking after midnight. You're a night owl?" Blomqvist shrugged. "It's turned out that way." He looked at several textbooks stacked on the edge of the kitchen table. "Do you still teach?"
"No. As headmistress, I don't have time. But I used to teach history, religion, social studies, and I have a few years left."
"Left?"
She smiled. "I'm 56. I'll be retiring soon."
"You don't look a day over 50. More like in your 40s.
"Very flattering. How old are you?"
"Well over 40, Blomqvist said with a smile.
"And you were just 20 the other day. How fast it all goes. Life, that is."
Cecilia Wanger served the coffee and asked if he was hungry. He said that he had already eaten, which was partly true. He did not bother with cooking and ate only sandwiches, but he was not hungry.
"Then why did you come over? Is it time to ask me those questions?"
"To be honest, I didn't come over to ask questions. I think I just wanted to say hello." She smiled.
"You're sentenced to prison. You move to Hedeby. Clamber through all the material of Henrik's favourite hobby. You don't sleep at night and take long night-time walks when it's freezing cold. Have I left anything out?"
"My life is going to the dogs."
"Who is that woman visiting you over the weekend?"
"Erica. She's the editor-in-chief of Millennium."
"Your girlfriend?"
"Not exactly. She's married. I'm more a friend and occasional lover." Cecilia Wanger hooted with laughter. "What's so funny?"
"The way you said that. Occasional lover. I like the expression."
Blomqvist took a liking to Cecilia Wanger.
"I could use an occasional lover myself," she said.
She kicked off her slippers and propped one foot on his knee. Blomqvist automatically put his hand on her foot and stroked the ankle. He hesitated for a second. He could sense he was getting into unexpected waters. But tentatively he started massaging the sole of her foot with his thumb.
"I'm married, too," she said.
"I know. No one gets divorced in the Wanger clan."
"I haven't seen my husband in getting on for 20 years.
"What happened?"
"That's none of your business. I haven't had sex in... it must be 3 years now."
"That surprises me."
"Why? It's a matter of supply and demand. I have no interest in a boyfriend, or a married man, or someone living with me. I do best on my own. Who should I have sex with? One of the teachers at school? I don't think so. One of the students? A delicious story for the gossiping old ladies. And they keep a close watch on people called Wanger. And here on Hedeby Island there are only relatives and people already married."
She leaned forward and kissed him on the neck.
"Do I shock you?"
"No. But I don't know whether this is a good idea. I work for your uncle."
"And I'm the last one who's going to tell. But to be honest, Henrik probably wouldn't have anything against it."
She sat astride him and kissed him on the mouth. Her hair was still wet and fragrant with shampoo. He fumbled with the buttons on her flannel shirt and pulled it down around her shoulders. She had no bra. She pressed against him when he kissed her breasts. Bureman came round the desk to show her the statement of her bank account, which she knew down to the last ora, although it was no longer at her disposal. He stood behind her. Suddenly he was massaging the back of her neck, and he let one hand slide from her left shoulder across her breasts. He put his hand over her right breast and left it there. When she did not seem to object, he squeezed her breast. Salander did not move. She could feel his breath on her neck as she studied the letter opener on his desk. She could reach it with her free hand. But she did nothing. If there was one lesson Holger Palmgren had taught her over the years, it was that impulsive actions lead to trouble, and trouble could have unpleasant consequences. She never did anything without first weighing the consequences. The initial sexual assault, which in legal terms would be defined as sexual molestation, and the exploitation of an individual in a position of dependence, and could in theory get Bjurman up to 2 years in prison, lasted only a few seconds. But it was enough to irrevocably cross a boundary. For Salander, it was a display of strength by an enemy force. An indication that aside from their carefully defined legal relationship, she was at the mercy of his discretion and defenseless. When their eyes met a few seconds later, his lips were slightly parted, and she could read the lust on his face. Salander's own face betrayed no emotions at all. Bjurman moved back to his side of the desk and sat on his comfortable leather chair.
"I can't hand out money to you whenever you like," he said. "Why do you need such an expensive computer? There are plenty of cheaper models that you can use for playing computer games."
"I want to have control of my own money like before."
Bjurman gave her a pitying look.
"We'll have to see how things go. First you need to learn to be more sociable and get along with people."
Bjurman's smile might have been more subdued if he could have read her thoughts behind the expressionless eyes.
"I think you and I are going to be good friends," he said. "We have to be able to trust each other."
When she did not reply, he said,
"You're a grown woman now, Lisbeth."
She nodded.
"Come here," he said,
and held out his hand. Salander fixed her gaze on the letter opener for several seconds before she stood up and went over to him. Consequences. He took her hand and pressed it to his crotch. She could feel his genitals through the dark gabardine trousers.
"If you're nice to me, I'll be nice to you."
He put his other hand around her neck and pulled her down to her knees with her face in front of his crotch.
"You've done this before, haven't you?"
he said, as he lowered his zip. He smelled as if he had just washed himself with soap and water. Salander turned her face away and tried to get up, but he held her in a tight grip. In terms of physical strength, she was no match for him. She weighed 90 pounds to his 210. He held her head with both hands and turned her face so their eyes met.
"If you're nice to me, I'll be nice to you," he repeated. "If you make trouble, I can put you away in an institution for the rest of your life. Would you like that?"
She said nothing.
"Would you like that?"
he said again. She shook her head. He waited until she lowered her eyes in what he regarded as submission. Then he pulled her closer. Salander opened her lips and took him in her mouth. He kept his grip on her neck and pulled her fiercely towards him. She felt like gagging the whole 10 minutes he took to bump and grind. When finally he came, he was holding her so tight she could hardly breathe. He showed her the bathroom in his office. Salander was shaking all over as she wiped her face and tried to rub off the spots on her sweater. She chewed some of his toothpaste to get rid of the taste. When she went back to his office, he was sitting impassively behind his desk, studying some papers.
"Sit down, Lisbeth," he told her without looking up.
She sat down. Finally, he looked at her and smiled.
"You're grown up now, aren't you, Lisbeth?"
She nodded.
"Then you also need to be able to play grown-up games," he said.
He used a tone of voice as if he were speaking to a child. She did not reply. A small frown appeared on his brow.
"I don't think it would be a good idea for you to tell anyone about our games.
Think about it. Who would believe you? There are documents stating that you're non-compos mentis. It would be your word against mine. Whose word do you think would carry more weight?" He sighed when still she did not speak. He was annoyed at the way she just sat there in silence, looking at him. But he controlled himself.
"We're going to be good friends, you and I," he said. "I think you were smart to come and see me today. You can always come to me."
"I need 10,000 kroner for my computer," she said, precisely.
as if she were continuing the conversation they were having before the interruption. Bierman raised his eyebrows. Hard-nosed bitch. She really is fucking retarded. He handed her the check he had written when she was in the bathroom. This is better than a whore. She gets paid with her own money. He gave her an arrogant smile. Salander took the check and left. Chapter 12. Wednesday, February 19th. If Salander had been an ordinary citizen, she would most likely have called the police and reported the rape as soon as she left Advocate Bierman's office. The bruises on her neck, as well as the DNA signature of his semen staining her body and clothing, would have nailed him, even if the lawyer had claimed that she wanted to do it, or she seduced me, or any other excuse that rapists routinely used. He would have been guilty of so many breaches of the guardianship regulations that he would instantly have been stripped of his control over her. A report would have presumably resulted in Salander being given a proper lawyer, someone well-versed in assaults on women, which in turn might have led to a discussion of the very heart of the problem, meaning the reason she had been declared legally incompetent. Since 1989, the term legally incompetent has no longer been applied to adults. There are two levels of social welfare protection, trusteeship and guardianship. A trustee steps in to offer voluntary help for individuals who, for various reasons, have problems managing their daily lives, paying their bills, or taking proper care of their hygiene. The person who is appointed as a trustee is often a relative or close friend. If there is no one close to the person in question, the welfare authorities can appoint a trustee. Trusteeship is a mild form of guardianship in which the client, the person declared incompetent, still has control over his or her assets and decisions are made in consultation with the trustee. Guardianship is a stricter form of control in which the client is relieved of the authority to handle his or her own money or to make decisions regarding various matters. The exact wording states that the guardian shall take over all of the client's legal powers. In Sweden, approximately 4,000 people are under guardianship. The most common reason for a guardianship is mental illness, or mental illness in conjunction with heavy abuse of alcohol or drugs. A smaller group includes those suffering from dementia. Many of the individuals under guardianship are relatively young, 35 or less. One of them was Lisbeth Salander. Taking away a person's control of her own life, meaning her bank account, is one of the greatest infringements a democracy can impose, especially when it applies to young people. It is an infringement even if the intent may be perceived as benign and socially valid. Questions of guardianship are therefore potentially sensitive political issues and are protected by rigorous regulations and controlled by the guardianship agency. This agency comes under the County Administrative Board and is controlled in turn by the Parliamentary Ombudsman. For the most part, the guardianship agency carries out its activities under difficult conditions, but considering the sensitive issues handled by the authorities, remarkably few complaints or scandals are ever reported in the media. Occasionally, there are reports that charges have been brought against some trustee or guardian who has misappropriated funds, or sold his client's co-op apartment and stuffed the proceeds into his own pockets. That those cases are relatively rare may be the result of two things. The authorities are carrying out their jobs in a satisfactory manner, or the clients have no opportunity to complain, and in a credible way make themselves heard by the media or by the authorities. The guardianship agency is bound to conduct an annual review to see whether any cause exists for revoking a guardianship. Since Salander persisted in her refusal to submit to psychiatric examination, she would not even exchange a polite good morning with her teachers, the authorities had never found any reason to alter their decision. Consequently, a situation of status quo had resulted, and so year after year she was retained under guardianship. The wording of the law states, however, that the conditions of a guardianship shall be adapted to each individual case. Palmgren had interpreted this to mean that Salander could take charge of her own money and her own life. He had meticulously fulfilled the requirements of the authorities and submitted a monthly report as well as an annual review. In all other respects, he had treated Salander like any other normal being, and he had not interfered with her choice of lifestyle or friends. He did not think it was either his business or that of society to decide whether the young lady should have a ring in her nose or a tattoo on her neck. This rather stubborn attitude vis-à-vis the district court was one of the reasons why they had got along so well. As long as Palmgren was her guardian, Salander had not paid much attention to her legal status. Salander was not like any normal person. She had a rudimentary knowledge of the law. It was a subject she had never had occasion to explore, and her faith in the police was generally exiguous. For her, the police were a hostile force who, over the years, had put her under arrest or humiliated her. The last dealing she had had with the police was in May of the previous year, when she was walking past Gutgarten on her way to Milton Security. She suddenly found herself facing a visor-clad riot police officer. Without the slightest provocation on her part, he had struck her on the shoulders with his baton. Her spontaneous reaction was to launch a fierce counterattack, using a Coca-Cola bottle that she had in her hand. The officer turned on his heel and ran off before she could injure him. Only later did she find out that Reclaim the Streets was holding a demonstration farther down the road. Visiting the offices of those visor-clad brutes to file a report against Nils Bjurman for sexual assault did not even cross her mind. And besides, what was she supposed to report? Bjurman had touched her breasts. Any officer would take one look at her and conclude that with her miniature boobs that was highly unlikely, and if it had actually happened, she should be proud that someone had even bothered. And the part about sucking his dick, it was, as he had warned her, her word against his, and generally, in her experience, the words of other people weighed more heavily than hers. The police were not an option. She left Bjurman's office and went home, took a shower, ate two sandwiches with cheese and pickles, and then sat on the worn-out sofa in the living room to think. An ordinary person might have felt that her lack of reaction had shifted the blame to her. It might have been another sign that she was so abnormal that even rape could evoke no adequate emotional response. Her circle of acquaintances was not large, nor did it contain any members of the sheltered middle class from the suburbs. By the time she was 18, Salander did not know a single girl who at some point had not been forced to perform some sort of sexual act against her will. Most of these assaults involved slightly older boyfriends who, using a certain amount of force, made sure that they had their way. As far as Salander knew, these incidents had led to crying and angry outbursts, but never to a police report. In her world, this was the natural order of things. As a girl, she was legal prey, especially if she was dressed in a worn black leather jacket and had pierced eyebrows, tattoos, and zero social status. There was no point whimpering about it. On the other hand, there was no question of Advocate Bjurman going unpunished. Salander never forgot an injustice, and by nature she was anything but forgiving. But her legal status was difficult. For as long as she could remember, she was regarded as cunning and unjustifiably violent. The first reports in her casebook came from the files of the school nurse from elementary school. Salander had been sent home because she hit a classmate and shoved him against a coat peg and drew blood. She still remembered her victim with annoyance, an overweight boy by the name of David Gustafsson, who used to tease her and throw things at her. He would grow up to be an arch bully. In those days she did not know what the word harassment meant, but when she came to school the next day the boy had threatened revenge, so she had decked him with a right jab fortified with a golf ball, which led to more bloodshed and a new entry in her casebook. The rules for social interaction in school had always baffled her. She minded her own business and did not interfere with what anyone around her did, yet there was always someone who absolutely would not leave her in peace. In middle school she had several times been sent home after getting into violent fights with classmates. Much stronger boys in her class soon learned that it could be quite unpleasant to fight with that skinny girl. Unlike the other girls in the class, she never backed down, and she would not for a second hesitate to use her fists or any weapon at hand to protect herself. She went around with the attitude that she would rather be beaten to death than take any shit. And she always got revenge. Salander once found herself in a fight with a much bigger and stronger boy. She was no match for him physically. At first he amused himself shoving her to the ground several times, then he slapped her when she tried to fight back, but nothing did any good. No matter how much stronger he was, the stupid girl kept attacking him, and after a while even his classmates began to realize that things had gone too far. She was so obviously defenseless it was painful to watch. Finally, the boy punched her in the face. It split open her lip and made her see stars. They left her on the ground behind the gym. She stayed at home for 2 days. On the morning of the third day she waited for her tormentor with a baseball bat, and she whacked him over the ear with it. For that prank she was sent to see the head teacher, who decided to report her to the police for assault, which resulted in a special welfare investigation. Her classmates thought she was crazy and treated her accordingly. She also aroused very little sympathy among the teachers. She had never been particularly talkative, and she became known as the pupil who never raised her hand, and often did not answer when a teacher asked her a direct question. No one was sure whether this was because she did not know the answer, or if there was some other reason, which was reflected in her grades. No doubt that she had problems, but no one wanted to take responsibility for the difficult girl, even though she was frequently discussed at various teachers' meetings. That was why she ended up in the situation where the teachers ignored her, and allowed her to sit in sullen silence. She left middle school and moved to another without having a single friend to say goodbye to. An unloved girl with odd behavior. Then, as she was on the threshold of her teenage years, all the evil happened, which she did not want to think about. The last outburst set the pattern and prompted a review of the casebook entries from elementary school. After that, she was considered to be legally, well, crazy. A freak. Salander had never needed any documents to know that she was different, but it was not something that bothered her for as long as her guardian was Holger Palmgren. If the need arose, she could wrap him around her little finger. With the appearance of Nils Bjurman, the declaration of incompetence threatened to become a troublesome burden in her life. No matter who she turned to, pitfalls would open up, and what would happen if she lost the battle? Would she be institutionalized? Locked up? There was really no option. Later that night, when Cecilia Wanger and Blomqvist were lying peacefully with their legs intertwined, and Cecilia's breasts resting against his side, she looked up at him.
"Thank you. It's been a long time. And you're not bad."
He smiled. That sort of flattery was always childishly satisfying. "It was unexpected, but I had fun."
"I'd be happy to do it again," Cecilia said, "if you feel like it."
He looked at her.
"You don't mean that you'd like to have a lover, do you?"
"An occasional lover," Cecilia said. "But I'd like you to go home before you fall asleep. I don't want to wake up tomorrow morning and find you here before I manage to do my exercises and fix my face. And it would be good if you didn't tell the whole village what we've been up to."
"Wouldn't think of it," Blomqvist said.
"Most of all, I don't want Isabella to know. She's such a bitch."
"And your closest neighbour. I've met her."
"Yes, but luckily she can't see my front door from her house. Mikhail, please be discreet."
"I'll be discreet."
"Thank you. Do you drink?"
"Sometimes."
"I've got a craving for something fruity with gin in it. Want some?"
"Sure."
She wrapped a sheet around herself and went downstairs. Blomqvist was standing naked looking at her bookshelves when she returned with a carafe of iced water and 2 glasses of gin and lime. They drank a toast.
"Why did you come over here?" she asked.
"No special reason, I just..."
"You were sitting at home, reading through Henrik's investigation, and then you came over here. A person doesn't need to be super intelligent to know what you've been brooding about."
"Have you read the investigation?"
"Parts of it. I've lived my entire adult life with it. You can't spend time with Henrik without being affected by the mystery of Harriet."
"It's actually a fascinating case."
"What I believe is known in the trade as a locked room mystery on an island. And nothing in the investigation seems to follow normal logic. Every question remains unanswered. Every clue leads to a dead end. It's the kind of thing people can get obsessed about."
"You were on the island that day?"
"Yes. I was here, and I witnessed the whole commotion. I was living in Stockholm at the time, studying. I wish I had stayed at home that weekend."
"What was she really like? People seem to have completely different views of her."
"Is this off the record, or?"
"It's off the record."
"I haven't the least idea what was going on inside Harriet's head. You're thinking of her last year, of course. One day she was a religious crackpot. The next day she put on makeup like a whore and went to school wearing the tightest sweater she possessed. Obviously she was seriously unhappy. But as I said, I wasn't here and just picked up the gossip.
What triggered the problems?
Gottfried and Isabella, obviously. Their marriage was totally haywire. They either parted or they fought. Nothing physical. Gottfried wasn't the type to hit anyone, and he was almost afraid of Isabella. She had a horrendous temper. Sometime in the early 60s he moved more or less permanently to his cabin, where Isabella never set foot. There were periods when he would turn up in the village looking like a vagrant, and then he'd sober up and dress neatly again and try to tend to his job.
Wasn't there anyone who wanted to help Harriet?
Henrik, of course. In the end she moved into his house. But don't forget, he was preoccupied playing the role of the big industrialist. He was usually off travelling somewhere and didn't have a lot of time to spend with Harriet and Martin. I missed a lot of this because I was in Uppsala, and then in Stockholm. And let me tell you, I didn't have an easy childhood myself with Harold as my father. In hindsight, I realized that the problem was that Harriet never confided in anyone. She tried hard to keep up appearances and pretend that they were one big happy family.
Denial.
Yes. But she changed when her father drowned. She could no longer pretend that everything was okay. Up until then, she was, I don't know how to explain it, extremely gifted and precocious, but on the whole a rather ordinary teenager. During the last year she was still brilliant, getting top marks in every exam and so on, but it seemed as if she didn't have any soul.
How did her father drown?
In the most prosaic way possible. He fell out of a rowing boat right below his cabin. He had his trousers open and an extremely high alcohol content in his blood, so you can just imagine how it happened. Martin was the one who found him.
I didn't know that.
It's funny. Martin has turned out to be a really fine person. If you had asked me 35 years ago, I would have said that he was the one in the family who needed psychiatric care.
Why so?
Harriet wasn't the only one who suffered ill effects from the situation. For many years, Martin was so quiet and introverted that he was effectively antisocial. Both children had a rough time of it. I mean, we all did. I had my own problems with my father. I assume you realize that he's stark, raving mad. My sister, Anita, had the same problem, as did Alexander, my cousin. It was tough being young in the Wanger family.
What happened to your sister?
She lives in London. She went there in the 70s to work in a Swedish travel agency, and she stayed. She married someone, never even introduced him to the family, and anon they separated. Today she's a senior manager of British Airways. She and I get along fine, but we're not much in contact and only see each other every other year or so. She never comes to Hedestad.
Why not?
An insane father. Isn't that explanation enough?
But you stayed.
I did. Along with Birger, my brother.
The politician.
Are you making fun of me? Birger is older than Anita and me. We've never been very close. In his own eyes, he's a fantastically important politician, with a future in Parliament and maybe ministerial rank if the Conservatives should win. In point of fact, he's a moderately talented local councillor in a remote corner of Sweden, which will probably be both the high point and the whole extent of his career.
One thing that tickles me about the Wanger family is that you all have such low opinions of each other.
That's not really true. I'm very fond of Martin and Henrik. And I always got on well with my sister, for all that we seldom see each other. I detest Isabella and can't abide Alexander, and I never speak to my father. So that's about 50-50 in the family. Birger is, well, more of a pompous fathead than a bad person. But I see what you mean. Look at it this way. If you're a member of the Wanger family, you learn early on to speak your mind. We do say what we think.
Oh, yes. I've noticed that you all get straight to the point. Blomqvist stretched out his hand to touch her breast. I wasn't here 15 minutes before you attacked me.
To be honest, I've been wondering how you would be in bed ever since I first saw you, and it felt right to try it out.
For the first time in her life, Salander felt a strong need to ask someone for advice. The problem was that asking for advice meant that she would have to confide in someone, which in turn would mean revealing her secrets. Who should she tell? She was simply not very good at establishing contact with other people. After going through her address book in her mind, she had, strictly speaking, 10 people who might be considered her circle of acquaintances.
She could talk to Plague, who was more or less a steady presence in her life, but he was definitely not a friend, and he was the last person on Earth who would be able to help solve her problem. Not an option. Salander's sex life wasn't quite as modest as she had led Advocate Bjorman to believe. On the other hand, sex had always, or at least most often, occurred on her conditions and at her initiative. She had had over 50 partners since the age of 15. That translated into approximately 5 partners per year, which was okay for a single girl who had come to regard sex as an enjoyable pastime, but she had had most of these casual partners during a 2-year period. Those were the tumultuous years in her late teens when she should have come of age. There was a time when Salander had stood at a crossroads and did not really have control over her own life, when her future could have taken the form of another series of casebook entries about drugs, alcohol, and custody in various institutions. After she turned 20 and started working at Milton Security, she'd calmed down appreciably and, she thought, had got a grip on her life. She no longer felt the need to please anyone who bought her 3 beers in a pub, and she did not experience the slightest degree of self-fulfillment by going home with some drunk whose name she could not remember. During the past year she had had only 1 regular sex partner, hardly promiscuous as her casebook entries during her late teens had designated her. For her, sex had most often been with one of a loose group of friends. She was not really a member, but she was accepted because she knew Scylla Noren. She met Scylla in her late teens when, at Palmgren's insistence, she was trying to get the school certificate she had failed to complete at Convox. Scylla had plum-red hair, streaked with black, black leather trousers, a ring in her nose, and as many rivets on her belt as Salander. They had glared suspiciously at each other during the first class. For some reason Salander did not understand, they had started hanging out together. Salander was not the easiest person to be friends with, and especially not during those years, but Scylla ignored her silences and took her along to the bar. Through Scylla she had become a member of Evil Fingers, which had started as a suburban band consisting of 4 teenage girls in Enskede who were into hard rock. 10 years later, they were a group of friends who met at Granen on Tuesday nights to talk trash about boys and discuss feminism, the pentagram, music, and politics, while they drank large quantities of beer. They also lived up to their name. Salander found herself on the fringe of the group and rarely contributed to the talk, but she was accepted for who she was. She could come and go as she pleased and was allowed to sit in silence over her beer all evening. She was also invited to birthday parties and Christmas glug celebrations, though she usually didn't go. During the 5 years she hung out with Evil Fingers, the girls began to change. Their hair colour became less extreme, and the clothing came more often from the H&M boutiques rather than from funky Mirorna. They studied or worked, and one of the girls became a mother. Salander felt as if she were the only one who had not changed a bit, which could also be interpreted as that she was simply marking time and going nowhere. But they still had fun. If there was one place where she felt any sort of group solidarity, it was in the company of the Evil Fingers, and, by extension, with the guys who were friends with the girls. Evil Fingers would listen. They would also stand up for her. But they had no clue that Salander had a district court order declaring her non compos mentis. She didn't want them to be eyeing her the wrong way, too. Not an option. Apart from that, she did not have a single ex-classmate in her address book. She had no network or support group or political contacts of any kind, so who could she turn to and tell about her problems? There might be one person. She deliberated for a long time about whether she should confide in Dragan Armansky. He had told her that if she needed help with anything, she should not hesitate to come to him, and she was sure that he meant it. Armansky had groped her one time, too, but it had been a friendly groping, no ill intentions, and not a demonstration of power. But to ask him for help went against the grain. He was her boss, and it would put her in his debt. Salander toyed with the idea of how her life would take shape if Armansky were her guardian instead of Bjorman. She smiled. The idea was not unpleasant, but Armansky might take the assignment so seriously that he would smother her with attention. That was, well, possibly an option. Even though she was well aware of what a women's crisis centre was for, it never occurred to her to turn to one herself. Crisis centres existed in her eyes for victims, and she had never regarded herself as a victim. Consequently, her only remaining option was to do what she had always done, take matters in her own hands and solve her problems on her own. That was definitely an option. And it did not bode well for Herr Advocate Nils Bjurman.
Chapter 13. Thursday, February 20th, to Friday, March 7th. During the last week of February, Salander acted as her own client, with Bjurman N., born 1950, as a high-priority special project. She worked almost 16 hours every day, doing a more thorough personal investigation than she had ever done before. She made use of all the archives and public documents she could lay her hands on. She investigated his circle of relatives and friends. She looked at his finances and mapped out every detail of his upbringing and career. The results were discouraging. He was a lawyer, member of the Bar Association, and author of a respectably long-winded but exceptionally tedious dissertation on finance law. His reputation was spotless. Advocate Bjurman had never been censured. On only one occasion was he reported to the Bar Association. He was accused nearly 10 years ago of being the middleman in an under-the-table property deal, but he had been able to prove his innocence. His finances were in good order. Bjurman was well-to-do, with at least 10 million kroner in assets. He paid more taxes than he owed, was a member of Greenpeace and Amnesty International, and he donated money to the Heart and Lung Association. He had rarely appeared in the mass media, although on several occasions he had signed his name to public appeals for political prisoners in the Third World. He lived in a 5-room apartment on Oplandsgarten near Odenplan, and he was the secretary of his co-op apartment association. He was divorced and had no children. Salander focused on his ex-wife, whose name was Elena. She was born in Poland, but had lived all her life in Sweden. She worked at a rehabilitation center and was apparently happily remarried to one of Bjurman's former colleagues. Nothing useful there. The Bjurman marriage had lasted 14 years, and the divorce went through without disputes. Advocate Bjurman regularly acted as a supervisor for youths who got into trouble with the law. He had been trustee for 4 youths before he became Salander's guardian. All of these cases involved minors, and the assignments came to an end with a court decision when they came of age. One of these clients still consulted Bjurman in his role as advocate, so there did not seem to be any animosity there either. If Bjurman had been systematically exploiting his wards, there was no sign of it. And no matter how deeply Salander probed, she could find no trace of wrongdoing. All four had established lives for themselves with a boyfriend or girlfriend. They all had jobs, places to live, and co-op debit cards. She called each of the 4 clients, introducing herself as a social welfare secretary working on a study about how children, hitherto under the care of a trustee, fared later in life compared to other children. "Yes, naturally, everyone will be anonymous." She had put together a questionnaire with 10 questions, which she asked on the telephone. Several of the questions were designed to get the respondents to give their views on how well the trusteeship had functioned, if they had any opinions about their own trustee. Advocate Bjurman, wasn't it? No one had anything bad to say about him. When Salander completed her ferreting, she gathered up the documents in a bag from Ica and put it out with the 20 bags of old newspapers out the hall. Bjurman was apparently beyond reproach. There was nothing in his past that she could use. She knew beyond a doubt that he was a creep and a pig, but she could find nothing to prove it. It was time to consider another option. After all the analyses were done, one possibility remained that started to look more and more attractive, or at least seemed to be a truly realistic alternative. The easiest thing would be for Bjurman simply to disappear from her life. A quick heart attack. End of problem. The catch was that not even disgusting 53-year-old men had heart attacks at her beck and call. But that sort of thing could be arranged. Blomqvist carried on his affair with headmistress Cecilia Wanger with the greatest discretion. She had 3 rules. She didn't want anyone to know they were meeting, she wanted him to come over only when she called and was in the mood, and she didn't want him to stay all night. Her passion surprised and astonished him. When he ran into her at Suzanne's, she was friendly but cool and distant. When they met in her bedroom, she was wildly passionate. Blomqvist did not want to pry into her personal life, but he had been hired to pry into the personal lives of everyone in the Wanger family. He felt torn, and at the same time curious. One day he asked Wanger whom she had been married to and what had happened. He asked the question while they were discussing the background of Alexandra and Birger.
"Cecilia? I don't think she had anything to do with Harriet."
"Tell me about her background."
"She moved back here after graduating and started working as a teacher. She met a man by the name of Jerry Carlson, who unfortunately worked for the Wanger Corporation. They married. I thought the marriage was a happy one, anyway, in the beginning. But after a couple of years, I began to see that things were not as they should be. He mistreated her. It was the usual story. He beat her, and she loyally defended him. Finally, he hit her one time too many. She was seriously hurt and ended up in the hospital. I offered my help. She moved out here to Hedeby Island and has refused to see her husband since. I made sure he was fired."
"But they are still married?"
"It's a question of how you define it. I don't know why she hasn't filed for divorce, but she has never wanted to remarry, so I suppose it hasn't made any difference."
"This Carlson, did he have anything to do with..."
"With Harriet? No, he wasn't in Herestad in 1966, and he wasn't yet working for the firm."
"Okay.
Mikhail, I'm fond of Cecilia. She can be tricky to deal with, but she's one of the good people in my family."
Salander devoted a week to planning Nils Bjurman's demise. She considered and rejected various methods until she had narrowed it down to a few realistic scenarios from which to choose. No acting on impulse. Only one condition had to be fulfilled. Bjurman had to die in such a way that she herself could never be linked to the crime. The fact that she would be included in any eventual police investigation she took for granted. Sooner or later her name would show up when Bjurman's responsibilities were examined. But she was only one person in a whole universe of present and former clients. She had met him only 4 times, and there would not be any indication that his death even had a connection with any of his clients. There were former girlfriends, relatives, casual acquaintances, colleagues and others. There was also what was usually defined as random violence, when the perpetrator and victim did not know each other. If her name came up, she would be a helpless, incompetent girl with documents showing her to be mentally deficient. So it would be an advantage if Bjurman's death occurred in such a complicated manner that it would be highly unlikely that a mentally handicapped girl could be the perpetrator. She rejected the option of using a gun. Acquiring a gun would be no great problem, but the police were awfully good at tracking down firearms. She considered a knife which could be purchased at any hardware store, but decided against that, too. Even if she turned up without warning and drove the knife into his back, there was no guarantee that he would die instantly and without making a sound, or that he would die at all. Worse, it might provoke a struggle which could attract attention, and blood could stain her clothes, be evidence against her. She thought about using a bomb of some sort, but it would be much too complicated. Building the bomb itself would not be a problem. The internet was full of manuals on how to make the deadliest devices. It would be difficult, on the other hand, to find a place to put the bomb so that innocent passers-by would not be hurt. Besides, there was again no guarantee that he would actually die. The telephone rang.
"Hi, Lisbeth. Dragan. I've got a job for you."
"I don't have time."
"This is important."
"I'm busy."
She put down the receiver. Finally, she settled on poison. The choice surprised her, but on closer consideration it was perfect. Salander spent several days combing the internet. There were plenty to choose from. One of them was among the most deadly poisons known to science, hydrocyanic acid, commonly known as prussic acid. Prussic acid was used as a component in certain chemical industries, including the manufacture of dyes. A few milligrams were enough to kill a person. 1 liter in a reservoir could wipe out a medium-sized city. Obviously, such a lethal substance was kept under strict control, but it could be produced in almost unlimited quantities in an ordinary kitchen. All that was needed was a modest amount of laboratory equipment, and that could be found in a chemistry set for children for a few hundred kroner, along with several ingredients that could be extracted from ordinary household products. The manual for the process was on the internet. Another option was nicotine. From a carton of cigarettes, she could extract enough milligrams of the substance and heat it to make a viscous syrup. An even better substance, although slightly more complex to produce, was nicotine sulfate, which had the property that it could be absorbed through the skin. All she would have to do was put on rubber gloves, fill a water pistol, and spray Bjurman in the face. Within 20 seconds he should be unconscious, and within a few minutes he would be dead as a doornail. Salander had had no idea that so many household products could be transformed into deadly weapons. After studying the subject for several days, she was persuaded that there were no technical impediments to making short work of her guardian. There were two problems. Bjurman's death would not of itself give her back control of her own life, and there was no guarantee that Bjurman's successor would be an improvement. Analysis of the consequences. What she needed was a way to control her guardian and thus her own situation. She sat on the worn sofa in her living room for one whole evening, running through the situation in her mind. By the end of the night, she had scrapped the idea of murder by poison and put together a new plan. It was not an appealing option, and it required her to allow Bjurman to attack her again. But if she carried it off, she would have won. At least, so she thought. By the end of February, Blomqvist fell into a daily routine that transformed his stay in Hedeby. He got up at 9 every morning, ate breakfast, and worked until noon. During this time he would cram new material into his head. Then he would take an hour-long walk, no matter what the weather was like. In the afternoon he would go on working, either at home or at Suzanne's Bridge Café, processing what he had read in the morning, or writing sections of what would be Wanger's autobiography. Between 3 and 6 he was always free. He would shop for groceries, do his laundry, go into Hedestad. Around 7 he would go over to see Wanger to ask him questions that had arisen during the day. By 10 he was home, and he would read until 1 or 2 in the morning. He was working systematically through Wanger's documents. The work of shaping the autobiography was moving smoothly. He had written 120 pages of the family chronicle in rough draft. He had reached the 1920s. Beyond this point he would have to move more slowly and start weighing his words. Through the library in Hedestad he had ordered books dealing with Nazism during that time, including Helene Luhr's doctoral dissertation, The Swastika and the Vasa Schief, which dealt with the symbols adopted by the German and Swedish Nazis. He had drafted another 40 pages about Wanger and his brothers, focusing on Wanger as the person holding the story together. He had a list of subjects he needed to research on the way the company operated during that time, and he had discovered that the Wanger family was also heavily involved in Ivar Kreuger's empire, another side story he had to explore. He estimated that he had about 300 pages left to write. According to the schedule he had devised, he wanted to have a final draft for Henrik Wanger to look at by the 1st of September, so that he could spend the autumn revising the text. For all his reading and listening, Blomqvist had made not an inch of progress in the Harriet Wanger case. No matter how much he brooded over the details in the files, he could find not a single piece of information that contradicted the investigative report. One Saturday evening in late February he had a conversation with Wanger in which he reported on his lack of progress. The old man listened patiently as Blomqvist listed all the dead ends he had run into.
"No crime is perfect," Wanger said. "I'm sure we must have missed something."
"We still can't say whether a crime was committed."
"Keep at it," Wanger said. "Finish the job."
"It's pointless."
"Maybe so, but don't give up."
Blomqvist sighed. "The telephone numbers," he said at last.
"Yes."
"They have to mean something."
"I agree."
"They were written down for some purpose."
"Yes."
"But we can't interpret them."
"No."
"Or else we're interpreting them wrong."
"Precisely."
"They're not telephone numbers. They mean something."
"Maybe so."
Mikhail sighed again and went home to continue reading. Advocate Bjurman was relieved when Salander called again and explained that she needed more money. She had postponed their most recent scheduled meeting with the excuse that she had to work, and a vague sense of uneasiness gnawed at him. Was she going to turn into an unmanageable problem child? But since she had missed the meeting, she had no allowance. and sooner or later she would be bound to come and see him. He could not help but be concerned that she might have discussed what had happened with some outsider. She was going to have to be kept in check. She had to understand who was in charge. So he told her that this time the meeting would be at his home near Odenplan, not at